Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Theater Podcast, intimate personal conversations with theater's biggest names. This episode is with lyricist and composer Rob Rakicki, who is probably most known for writing the music and the lyrics for The Lightning Thief, the Percy Jackson musical, which, if you have not been following this musical, has had an amazing trajectory. It started out years ago as just a literally just a one-hour small touring show that TheaterWorks USA commissioned, and the creative team had six actors playing over 30 parts, I think he said, and then it went to off-Broadway, and then it started touring again, and then now it's on Broadway for a limited run, and I have never, ever seen a show have a trajectory like that, and I think, you know, that speaks to sort of the generation of the people who really want it. Sort of like Be More Chill, right? So it went from the smaller thing, and then the soundtrack was made, and then because of technology and the internet and the way that younger people are now starting to, even people listening to this podcast possibly, are looking to identify themselves on stage or find themselves and find others who are in the same sort of struggle. And, oh gosh, it just speaks to so many people. And then Rob here too was saying that even as adults, we don't ever really feel like we find ourselves, maybe? I mean, most people don't. I'm speaking for myself. I'm always kind of searching for that next thing or searching for that next point of identification or purpose or whatever it is. So these stories like Percy Jackson and even Harry Potter and, The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, these young adult novels that have just become movies and become shows or whatever it is, they speak to the nostalgia. They create this sense of home, I think, for younger people, and then it starts translating. So I wish that all of you could have actually seen this episode visually. I mean, you're going to hear it, but I was just enthralled by watching Rob talk about his love for storytelling. He started out as an actor, and I can tell, like, he found his home as a writer and as a composer because he just goes into these modes where his eyes light up. He talks about the need to identify with the characters and care about them and why are we there? I'm really excited for all of you guys to listen to this. One more point before we get into it. He is now the second person recently who's told me how theater helps people, especially younger people, practice empathy. And that's something, of course, you know, in the age we are in now, where there's a lot of hate and there's a lot of bigotry and there's a lot of racism and there's a lot of whatever it is, toxic masculinity, everything that goes in and around our culture. I mean, I'm talking, of course, what my experience is in North America and the United States, but, you know, as a kind of a global bigger thing where we just need to kind of understand each other. And he said something too, where he doesn't want to have us as a society other people, where he means like saying it's not us, it's them, it's the others, right? So I don't know. I just really enjoyed this conversation. Anyway, I'm rambling a little bit. Sorry about that. Let's get into the episode. But before we do, as always, please visit me online at thetheaterpodcast.com. Show your support via thetheaterpodcast.com/Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And find me online on Instagram and Twitter. Please send me a message. I love hearing from everybody. So please enjoy this episode with Rob Rakicki. My guest today is an actor, music director, composer, and lyricist whose shows have been nominated for Drama Desk, Lortel, and Off-Broadway Alliance Awards. He's a member of the Dramatists Guild, Actors Equity, and an alum of the Tony Award-winning BMI Musical Theater Writing Workshop. He wrote the music and lyrics for the critically acclaimed Broadway musical, The Lightning Thief, the Percy Jackson musical, currently finishing up its limited run on Broadway. Rob Rakicki, welcome to the Theater Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me out.
Okay, so let's go back to baby Rob, little Rob. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in, it was considered unincorporated Arapahoe County at the time. Now it's Centennial, Colorado. It's about a half hour east of Denver.
Yeah, okay, I was going to say, like, you were saying names and I had no idea where they
plains,
were. And then, okay.
The Plains.
The Plains.
Yeah.
We're now, marijuana has become legalized.
Yeah.
So what was your childhood like? Obviously, it was before legal weed.
Yeah. I did a lot. I hung out outside a lot. My dad is like a big hiker too, so we did a lot of like Colorado hiking adventures. But like most of the time, I was just riding my bikes, you know. And then my parents only listened to classical music. They love classical music, so we would have like the car trips. It was like name that composer, you know. Shostakovich or whatever. You're like, great. But they also love classic musicals too. Like, especially if it was like opera singers covering it, because they would like, you know, those versions, which, you know, not always my favorite to listen to now, especially as a guy that writes rock musicals. But like the original cast recording of like Candide would be in our car, or like West Side Story with like Kiri Tuikanawa or whoever. So I did fall in love with some of those classics like that way. And I have a twin sister too. And one Christmas we got like boom boxes and we discovered Bon Jovi and Bruce Springsteen.
On the radio?
Yeah, just on the radio. And I was like, what is this Black Magic on the radio? What is this devil's music, this rock and roll? I was like obsessed with like soul music when I was a kid too. So like my dad and I, it's funny, I'd be like, Dad, you got to listen to this, whatever, you know, when I was 13, Radiohead song. And he'd be like, no, the meter is interesting, but I can't understand the lyrics. Like, lyrics are not important to my parents. They're important to me. But we could get along together listening to like classic albums, like some of the Beatles stuff, but also like some Motown things too.
Oh, really?
That we could get to. So like, you know, that was fun. I remember dragging my parents to see the Pointer Sisters do Ain't Misbehavin', which was a hoot, and things like that. So like, it was funny, like for a guy that grew up listening to just classical music, like the fact that I discovered the Chess soundtrack, I was like, oh wait, what is this newfangled rock and roll mixed with musical theater? And so I was like kind of hooked from then on of like, oh, I want to do that. I want to write like pop rock stuff.
Were you originally like going towards a career of writing classical music?
No, not at all. I mean, my dad, you know, he's a doctor, but he was a classical pianist, a really good one. And my mom was singing in choir. So like, it was just music was around. My grandparents, my grandmothers were both singers. So like, you know, singing things were around, but it was not like, oh yeah, that's what I'm going to do.
Did your parents want you to?
No, they didn't care one way or another. They're just super supportive. They just knew like little Robbie wants to do, you know, Wilson Pickett at his like talent show in eighth grade. I was like, probably not, you know, the smartest thing to have this little high pitched white kid singing Wilson Pickett, but you know, whatever. Colorado. They were very supportive. And I think because I didn't know any better, I just thought, well, I like doing this. Mm-hmm. I want to keep doing this. And then I just never stopped. It was never a point where there was like a hard and fast decision. It just kind of things just, oh, well, this is what I do. Since like I was first grade, that was what I did. I did a play. And then I was like, you know, oh, I like this.
And were you in the play? Were you on stage as an actor?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, there's no pit in a first grade production.
Well, you know, I think it was a pianist. It was a play called Goin' Buggy. I played the lawyer who I think the bugs were trying to get equal rights, and I was the lawyer that was like, no. But then I had a change of heart, and I'm like, yes, I vote that they do. And I had one line, and I literally was like, oh wow, I have so much power on the stage. It was a pure ego at the start. But then, like, throughout that, I started acting. But I was always writing weird little songs, making up things. My dad would get mad because I would, like, swing the Moonlight Sonata. And he's like, it doesn't go that way. Beethoven doesn't write it that way. I'm like, but it's fun if you, you know. So, I wrote a really angsty musical. Well, I wrote a really weird one in high school called Mass Confusion. The title given to me by my dad because he couldn't understand the script, which I was like, yes, Mass Confusion. It was like set at a golf course and there were aliens. and it was a mess. But it was really fun. And there was some weird little songs and that. But then I was like, oh, I'm going to be a serious writer. And I had this great idea to write a Jekyll and Hyde musical. I'm born on Halloween. My twin sister and I are born on Halloween. So I'm very like drawn to monsters. And I was like, Jekyll and Hyde musical. And I had the poster designed. And my mom at like a Virgin Megastore or something was like, oh, Robbie, look. And it was like a concept recording of the album. It was like early. It was like the Colm Wilkinson one, like way back in the day. I was like, my dream shattered. No one will hear the silence before the storm. The great song that, I mean, yes, this is the moment. give it up. But Robert Hickey at age 13, The Silence Before the Storm for the Jekyll and Hyde musical with a fantastic poster that he designed himself. Man, it could have changed the world.
Do you still have the poster?
I got it somewhere. It was really good. I was really proud of it. Dream shattered. It was a good lesson to learn early on of like, get used to disappointment, kid. Figure out another way of telling a different story.
What did your sister end up doing?
So my sister is a publicist. She works like literally around the corner. She is the director of publicity at Random House for a bunch of books. She would always give me like the coolest books. She also worked for like a rock magazine, The Deli, for a while. So we first moved to New York in the early 2000s. We were just like going to concerts. Last week we went to see the Pixies together, which we hadn't done in forever. But she just was working on Prince's book that just came out. So she's very cool. But yeah, she would always hand me some cool book that I'd be like, oh, I don't want to read that. She handed me the Alexander Hamilton book. I was like, this is really dry. I don't know. And then she gave me Gone Girl, which I loved, and The Martian, which was cool. You get these galley copies. That's the thing that's so cool about working with, you know, my sister get these books and you don't know if they're going to be a national bestseller. You don't know if they're going to be, you know, what they are. She's just like, I got a feeling about this. This is special. And she'd like share it with me and be like, oh, this is so cool.
Well, obviously the Hamilton book. Oh, and influenced a couple people.
Yeah. But isn't that funny too? That like how it something speak to you and you just immediately latch on. You're like, oh, I see myself reflected in XYZ, and then it's like, I gotta do something with that, or I want to tell my side of the story through that medium or that book or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Both of you found your way to New York City.
Yeah, and we literally moved August of 2001, so it was a very interesting time to kind of get acclimatized to New York in the following weeks and such after. But I think it was like there was something about being in New York in that time too, after such devastation of this sense of community and wanting to stick it out and wanting to like make things and help people make things, and like, so I feel like we kind of like. We're kind of that foundation of wanting to stick it out kind of grew out of that time period.
Did you move together?
No. She went to school up at this tiny little college, Colby College. I think actually Hillary Clinton went there. It's in the middle of Maine, in the middle of nowhere. It's beautiful, but it's like remote. And I went to school at the University of Michigan.
Another UM. Well, speaking of books and whatnot, like Rick Riordan obviously wrote the book The Lightning Thief. Yeah. When did that book come out? I didn't look this up.
I think 2005, I want to say. It was mid-2000s.
Yeah, yeah, so you were in New York before the book came out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm a little older, so I missed the craze of the Percy Jackson books. But I was a fan of YA literature. I especially like YA gothic horror and stuff like that, you know. Dean Koontz and stuff like that. But also like earlier than that, when I was a kid, John Belair's like The House with the Clock in its Walls and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. That was kind of early YA stuff. And I liked horror and I liked like fantasy stuff.
I read a lot of Hardy Boys.
Yeah, yeah. Well, those mysteries and things, yeah, some of those could get pretty creepy. I liked them. But yeah, so I missed the kind of cusp of when you might get introduced to that. But I always loved Greek myths. My mom was also a history teacher. So I had this big book of Greek myths with these scary drawings that I was like, oh, that's so cool. The Kraken, you know, everything.
Oh, yeah. Clash of the Titans was one of my favorite movies.
Oh, my God.
That's
the best. With the stop motion, Harry.
The
stop motion. Oh,
the original
God.
One. Not, oh, yeah. No. Not the remake. From a couple years ago.
But I would say, I watched the sequel the other day. I was like really sick and I just watched the sequel of the sequel updated one. And is the sequel to the remake to the updated one just came out. I actually like had a blast. I was like, oh, Liam Neeson playing a god. You got to love it.
I have a particular set of skills. And it's creating lightning.
Zeus skills.
Let me tell you.
the mythology part, is that kind of what attracted you to Percy Jackson? I mean, tell me your story of getting...
What attracted me was I was kind of struggling at the end of my, what am I doing with my life? And I got a call from a friend of mine, Joe Iconis, who was like, hey, they're looking for writers who write rock music. And this is a thing I think you're going to like. You should put your hat in the ring for this thing. And you know, like all good things, it's usually your friends that like suggest or help or talk or whatever that like get you out of your funk. I was in a really weird place because I had just booked like this is 2012-ish. I had booked a show called Pump Poison Dinettes that was going to have this big revival. John Doyle was going to direct. It was gonna this whole thing. I learned accordion for like 3 months as an actor. And this is my Broadway debut. Oh my gosh. I was understudying my old classmate, Alexander Gemignani. So I was really stoked to see him again. It was like going to change my life. It was, you know, and we got an announcement on Friday that, hey, we're postponing on Monday and our like first rehearsal. And I'm like, well, wait, we were all off book. We'd learned the set had been built, you know what I'm saying? And they were like, yeah, we're extending. And then, or we're delaying. And then another, we're delaying. And then it just was like, it fell apart. And as things happen in this industry. Mm-hmm. But I think it was the double whammy was like that week was the week that another show I wrote called Strange Tales that I had done at Ars Nova was supposed to have a production out in California. And our producers dropped us like that week after a year of like negotiations. Mm-hmm. We went to like celebrate and they were like, yeah, we're going to grad school. So we're not going to produce your show. It's the best thing for the project. And I was like, well, the best thing for the project would have been not having you have the option for the past year, but whatever. So it was like this double whammy of like losing the show that I love so much that I had worked on and losing this thing as an actor. So I was just like, what am I doing? And I was looking for anything that I could as a storyteller, because like when your sense of identity has been robbed of you and like the only thing you know how to do is like, give me a da, 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 da. Yeah, I was literally chorus line, you know, give me something to hold on to here. And that's when I found out about this project. So I like wrote demos for it. I read the book voraciously. I thought it was really great. I laughed and laughed. And I remembered thinking that like that when I get upset as an actor or as a storyteller in general, as an artist, like YA in particular is so helpful because like Harry Potter, you know, like the fifth book of the Harry Potter series is my favorite because it's like the one where he's up against the most, you know, the system, man, it's got him down. And you know what I mean? Nobody believes him. And that character that Percy, you know, in Lightning Thief, that he's this kid that just can't catch a break. I suddenly was like, I see myself in this kid. And I think we're all in a state of arrested development a bit, wherever we're at. You know, the older I get, the more I realize that like real life is just high school with more money. Do you know what I mean? It's just the same kinds of things of people that are scared and people still trying to win their parents' affections and people still trying to, you know, live in these kind of cycles of pick their, you know, battles of other people before them. And I was just, and how Greek that is, you know, in the grand scheme of things. So I really did love the book and I thought, oh, I have a way in with this and the kind of angst of those teens. I know how to write that music.
What's the audition process like as a composer and a lyricist? Because obviously you're not auditioning like sure. a traditional actor, but you said you throw your hat in the ring. So it's not like Joe right. called you up and said, you've got this.
No. It was very much, I had to earn it. But so Joe Trace had seen the book on his agent's desk at the time. And Joe Trace is an incredible book writer. This was his first musical, though. This was before Be More Chill, yeah. before Netflix, you know, Lemony Snicket. You know, he loved those Percy Jackson books. He really, was like, I whatever I have to do to adapt that, I want to adapt that. And so they did as a play, basically. And very early on in the process, TheaterWorks was like, we need to compress more plot. This thing should sing. I think we can. And it was such a coup for TheaterWorks, you know, been around forever to get a title this big. We had, you know, to win over Rick's agents and all this stuff because they've been so badly mm-hmm. burned by the movies and stuff like that. You know, it's just like, we wanted to get the tone right, all that stuff. So it was like little battles, picking little battles and getting them to win every time. So Joe had adapted it. And then they chose a bunch of different writers to submit. Like this happens a lot where different mm-hmm. writers will submit, different teams will submit. Sometimes they're music lyricist team, you know, one guy does one, right. somebody else does another. But I submitted like three demos and that's what got me the job. They thought it fit the best with the tone that they were going for. So we were off to the races. But yeah, the weird thing is those three songs I think I made for those demos, they're the only songs that have like really not changed that much in the course of this whole craziness of the past 7 years of 8 million versions and 20,000 songs that were written and cut for this thing. So I think that, you know, it's so funny that like the heart of and tone that I was trying so hard to nail out of the gate, it's like I did a good enough job of that it stuck with us and we're like, okay, I got it.
I wonder if, you know, Have you ever had the conversation with Joe Trace about whether it was Chicken or the Egg, where like they had the tone in mind and then your songs fit that, or if they were looking to find the tone and they're like, oh, these songs are what we want. Like, now that we've heard it, that's what we want.
I think it's a little of, you know, I think it's a little of they know what they're looking for, and then but they don't know how to articulate it. It's just as soon as they hear it, they're like, oh, that's it.
Yeah.
They get it. You know, it's like it fits. And I'm sure the other writers that submitted were fantastic writers, and you know, probably booked other jobs I didn't. But the kind of heart and humor that the books have, it's, you know, these are kids from broken homes. They don't have a lot of means. Of course, he has ADHD and dyslexia, but they're snarky. They're very kind of Americanized. They're, you know, if people try to compare it with the, you know, Harry Potter, which mm-hmm. there obviously are examples or comparisons to be made, but they're very unique in its kind of that specific tone. And I wanted to get that right. And I think that's what the songs tried to do. And they were like, okay, yeah, that's a good fit.
So the history, I guess the timeline of the show in general, you mentioned Theater Works. So Theater yeah. Works... Was it them who hired Joe to
yeah.
then? They like, we have this idea, yeah, we want to capitalize on
yep.
it. Yeah.
So they hired Joe. Joe wrote this play. Then they were like, we need to have music. So they hired me. And then we wrote demos. Then we did a lot of R&D. And Rick's agents would come in. Joe met with Rick, actually, and kind of see how his brain worked. And, mm-hmm. you know, we really wanted to win them over because we know the fans had been burned so badly because the films hadn't gotten the tone right. You know, it's very hard in a Hollywood system to like, you know, it's by a committee, and I don't blame the actors. I don't blame anybody. It's just hard. And I know Rick was disappointed in kind of that, you know, when you let your baby go into someone else's hands, what happens? So I think he was very reticent. There we go. It's late. To you know, have us take over his property again. So we had to constantly do R&D. We would like bring in kids that were from Camp Half-Blood camps that are in Long Island, you know, that they do these like reenactments and stuff. We brought in his, you know, obviously his agents were like, you can't do that. You can't combine that character. You can't this and this and this. We had six actors playing like 30 characters for the original 1 hour. You know, it's a lot of plot, right? It's a nearly 400 page book. We were putting in like a 1 hour musical at first.
Yeah.
So it was, but it actually became kind of fun in terms of like, great. Well, we have six actors and we can't keep combining things. We just have to do it all. Great. We will do it literally like the most theatrical, fun, frenetic roller coaster ride, and they'll play 30 characters, and there'll be monsters and things that we'll throw at them, and so that's kind of how we attacked it. And Stephen Brackett came on pretty early in the process. We met with a lot of really fantastic directors, but Stephen's kind of out of the box thinking. He comes from like off Broadway, impossible theater. Never be able to put this on stage, and you're like, yeah, great. We have a monster. We got a guy that comes out of a wheelchair and turns into a centaur. We have a, you know, a minotaur that's like on a murdering rampage. We have like bad demon fury things. You know, how do you wrangle that and make it fun and fast and truly embrace the theatrical nature of the storytelling? And originally had to tour in a band, and we had, you know, it was like so many constraints that we had that actually helped us in how we were going to tell the story.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? Cause it was like, these are kids from, you know, without much means. So here we are, actors without much means, telling the story with this kind of detritus left on stage, taking agency on how they're going to tell their story. Just like the themes of taking agency, of making the change you want to see in the world and all that kind of stuff. It felt very fitting. The kind of the way that we told the story and how we told the story.
So what year did the Theater Works tour start?
2013, we had like a little mini tour. We jokingly call it the Minotaur. It was just a piano. Oh, I'm filled with puns. We just did a piano and we tested around different schools. Okay, you know, kids are like, they're brutal audiences. They'll let you know if things are working or not, or if we did their book justice or not, you know, the fans. And also kids that had not read the books, you had to make sure that they understood the world enough that it wasn't as confusing.
Mm-hmm.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary, and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shana Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
So we did a lot of little mini tours, and then we didn't think we'd get the rights to have a sit down in New York at all. But Nancy Marietta, Rick's agents, got the rights away from the film studio after the second movie kind of tanked, and we were able to. And so it was part of free summer theater. A lot of kids from underserved areas, families that came out and never seen a musical before got to see this show. It really was special. And then that, because how weird that what happened was, our little one-hour TYA family-friendly show got nominated against Hamilton for Outstanding Musical for a Laura Tell Award. And everybody was like, what? And Michael Friedman's beautiful shows. He had Fortress of Solitude, which is such an amazing show. So it was incredible. And I think everybody's ears kind of perked up. And so that little one-hour tour toured around for a couple months. I think almost 2 years. We had six of those. And then we expanded it, you know, and made a two-act and kind of ripped the show apart and started over in a lot of ways, trying to add in a lot of the stuff that we had to cut before. And that's where songs like Good Kid and like the main kind of character songs, where we actually, as Steven likes to say, instead of cramming more plot, we actually tried to like sit with the characters a bit more, to give it a little more gravitas, to raise the stakes a bit more, let the show breathe a little more. Joe likes to say that it's like before it was the roller coaster and now you have the amusement park, which I like in terms of our looking at our show. So that was kind of the creation of it. Then thought the show was dead. Well, not dead, just over. It was great. It ran 2 months at the Lortel. Mm-hmm. Hooray for us. We did it, you know. Everybody seemed really happy. And then Broadway Records came, made an album, and that changed everything. Tour, which was amazing. And then we thought the tour was over. And then Broadway. I've never seen a show with the trajectory of it. Started out as a one-hour, you know, TYA show turning into a full-fledged Broadway musical.
No, that's what I have written down here, actually, was to talk about the trajectory. It just went from a one-hour thing to this massive two-hour Broadway run.
Yeah.
Or two-act Broadway run.
Yeah.
How long is it now?
Yeah, it's 2 hours. It's 2 hours and 15, and not even. It's like 2 hours
right.
About, but it is a two-act show. It's definitely for everyone. It's not designed for kids. And even the little, or I mean, obviously it's designed for everyone, including kids. But even the original show that was a little looking for a slightly younger demographic, we still wrote it for ourselves. You know, we still were like, what I love so much about the show is you get the wave of laughter from like the youngins that find the things that they relate to. And then you get a wave of laughter from the adults or whatever. When the jokes land or the things hit in different places, that's that sweet spot, which is so, so satisfying as a writer. And that's been a joy. The demographics that we have at this show is unlike anything I've ever seen.
That's what I was going to ask about was, whether you see if it's, I mean, because Broadway ticket prices are more expensive, you have to have more disposable income. So, like going from the 1 hour tour, TheaterWorks plays more to younger audiences.
Sure.
Now on Broadway, which plays more to older audiences.
Sure.
Has the show maintained, like, obviously, it's maintained an upward trajectory, but in terms of audience feedback, has that changed?
Well, I mean, like the show is a family friendly show, but like we've had a repeat guy that keeps coming, he's like 85, who sits in the front row. But we've also tried to keep ticket prices low, thanks to our producers, you know, because the theater should be for everyone. And, you know, it is a problem in our industry. Our industry of musicals theater, which we love so much, Broadway, right, is classist. It just is. It's money is unfortunately a major issue that prevents art from getting to the audiences it needs to. you know, and so I'm very proud that our show is able to try to be as inclusive as possible, and aware of those things. And mm-hmm. part of the joy of the tour was getting to go to, you know, all these cities all over the country, and you know, in these gigantic, beautiful theaters, and be having families be able to afford to come and see it with everybody. But yes, that is a thing, and that is a, you know, it's something that we're very mindful of. But you know, if you're paying XYZ to see a show, you want to see it. A show, you know, and that is a conversation to have too. Of like, what are you paying for? Do you need spectacle to have, or is, you know, and our show does have spectacle. I think in terms of the actors and some of these incredible like theatrical moments. I'm not going to give too many things away, but it is it's a really interesting conversation about like accessibility to theater and audiences. But we have a lot of people. This is their first show they've ever seen. A lot.
And we have younger audiences,
people that are fans of the books that read the books when they were in their teens and now that are in their 20s and 30s that are like, I want to see kind of relive mm-hmm. my favorite character on stage. Adults that are reading the books currently to their kids. They want to come and see it, like date night and stuff like that. It's so funny. I get so many like, you know, letters and tweets and things from parents that are like, we took our kids and we ended up having the best time ever, you know? And then there are these kids. They're there at the Stage Door every night. They see themselves in this show, and it's the greatest feeling in the whole world. You know, when someone says, I want to be a writer because of you, or, I want to be an actor, or this story means the world to me, or this story helped me get through whatever. And to see the impact that it's had, I think they're the generation that's going to help kind of keep this industry going and pave the way. And so to not discredit them and to embrace them as an audience is really important for a lot of shows. And I think shows like Be More Chill, shows like Lightning Thief, shows like We Are Tigers, or, you know, they are appealing to this younger, hungry demographic that I feel like are belittled a lot of time in the mainstream press in some ways. And they're smart and they're capable and they're going to be the ones running stuff soon enough. You know what I mean?
We went to
Arkansas when we started, and in Arkansas when we did our out of town, you know, before the show started in previews, one of the guys that worked there was like, "Hey, raise your hand if this is your first musical," and like half the audience raised their hand. And people said,
in Arkansas.
And then, yeah. And then he said, raise your hand if you drove here, from out of the state.
Wow.
And like the other half of the, it was nuts. People flew in from Japan. People drove for like hours and hours out to Arkansas in January, in the middle of nowhere to see our show. That's how much this property means to people. And that's how much like this cast album means to people. And for a lot of people who come from the comic book world or come from the literature world, or to bring in a new audience into theater, and especially, and this is the thing I'm not like talking about, but I think is actually the most important, a demographic of young boys. Because if we're talking about kind of the world in general and toxic masculinity and patriarchy and groupthink and all the things that like, you know, concern me, a lot of that stems from an early age and how we find empathy or not. Mm-hmm. And if you see, you know, if young men see themselves on stage and see empathy and see smart, capable women kicking butt, even in fantasy is great because it's a metaphor that, you know, it's not quite so literal. You can mm-hmm. kind of get behind it. Man, that to me feels like a little bit revolutionary in some ways, or, you know, or it's very inspiring to think that these kids maybe we're helping the world make it a little bit better.
Absolutely. And I can't remember who I was having this conversation with. So if whoever it is you're listening, I'm sorry, I can't credit you. But whoever it was told me that part of what is, maybe it was Tanya Pinkins. I think it was Tanya Pinkins.
Yeah?
That kids, people in general, not just kids, but mm-hmm. I mean, to your point, especially kids that need to learn how to have empathy and mm-hmm. how to have understanding for others and feel these other types of emotions in different situations. You only forge those neural pathways being in the moment.
Yeah.
And unless you're, like, you don't want to be under stress, you don't want to see people in bad situations in real life. So by seeing it on stage, then you're allowing your brain to actually form those connections and get a better understanding of what empathy is without actually having, I put in air quotes, real situations.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's credit to you for recognizing that as well. But absolutely agree that it makes people, arts in general, but especially theater, and then when you add the music to it, it activates more centers of the brain.
I'm
so much about brain chemistry and
yeah.
and whatnot. But seeing a musical theater production on stage that speaks to you literally is making you a better person.
Yeah.
And what you were saying about people flying in from Japan and going to Arkansas in the middle of nowhere, I think my hypothesis around that is that they're going back to relive that nostalgia.
Yes.
Because as a child, mm-hmm. like you said, they saw themselves in these books and they yeah. got attached to these books. And it's the same reason Harry Potter's doing well.
Yeah.
Because you go back and you see these stories.
Right. And you know, we see it in media, in other media, like, you know, obviously the Avengers films and things like that, superhero stories and things like that, which, you know, always started back in the Greeks, right?
Right.
But the demographic is family and tweens watching all those together. Everybody of all ages loves these movies. Why don't we tap into that demographic in theater? It's because obviously price, mm-hmm. but also I think it has a lot to do with the tastemakers saying, well, this form there, you know, there's only room on Broadway for this type of art, and it has to be at this highbrow, whatever. But to me, I think the joy of seeing a diverse season on Broadway where you have all kinds of shows. You can have a Freestyle of Supreme and a Slave Play and a Lightning Thief and a Moulin Rouge and a Jagged Little Pill. You know, I feel like new musical theater this year has been so thrilling in taking charge of different demographics and stories and things like Soft Power I just saw a couple weeks mm-hmm. ago. My God, so cool. Or like Strange Loop. You know, these shows that are just like pushing the envelope, Octet. I mean, like there's so many cool shows.
The Sound Inside, just
yeah.
this psychological thriller is amazing.
Right?
Yeah.
There's so much cool theater happening. And I think if you give a platform for it and say it belongs, all of it is valid. And to have an audience that it doesn't have to be, theater doesn't have to be relegated to just, a certain income bracket of people. I mean, part of that is economics of getting, you know, trying to figure out other ways to get mm-hmm. people in there. But I think also it has a lot to do with perception, you know, and I think also a producer's taking a chance and saying, you know, how can we do maybe things more like limited runs or other tours or other ways of getting theater to the people? I know that it's a question that Sam Pinkleton and I had a while ago talking about Soft Power at the Public, you know. How do we get people who we know need to see this mm-hmm. to see it? You know, it's an ongoing thing.
To your point, too, to get younger people involved, younger people in general, I think, are more active on social media. Mm-hmm. And as your life gets older, you know, you have kids or you get more responsibilities. I found, at least through personal experience, that my social media attention has been waning. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like it. You want to spread something by word of mouth? Like, yeah. look at Be More Chill and look yeah. at Lightning Thief. Like, yeah. literally, these young audiences just spread this success by word of mouth.
Yeah.
And then they've become what they've become. And
look at Beetlejuice.
Yeah. Well, yeah. current Ryan Murphy situation aside.
Right.
But yes, Beetlejuice revived itself completely through TikTok.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, what I will call a young person's game. Because I don't want to play that game.
Yeah. But yeah, it's interesting. And I think history will be kind to our show and to the shows of this season. I think 2019 will be a kind of a seminal year people will look back on at theater in general. And like, there is a changing of a guard. There is a bit of a revolution in the works. I mean, working with friends like Joe Trace and Michael R. Jackson and Shakina Nafik and Joe Iconis, these people that I adore, that I know, they're breaking down barriers. Mm-hmm. Things are shaking shit up.
Yeah, I think when you're in it for the art and for the teaching and not just the money, mm-hmm. like the changing of the guard, I take that to mean more of like it's shifting from power to the producers, which producers, of course, will always have to have some power.
Sure.
But producers back towards others, towards the people who are the creators.
Well, and producers that are collaborators in another way too. It's mm-hmm. not just producers. It's just gatekeepers, quite honestly, you know, of like having them be more open to being collaborative mm-hmm. and how we get this art made and who gets to see that art.
Yeah, I agree. You mentioned comics a couple mm-hmm. times and graphic novels and stuff. Mm-hmm. I have a Patreon account and I let people submit some of their questions, and one of them came in about the Monster Songs graphic novel. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, please. Okay.
No, so Monster Songs. The question is, I heard about Monster Songs, each story drawn by a different artist who wrote, and you wrote a whole album, mm-hmm. musical album about it too. So the question is, what exactly is Monster Songs and how do you define it?
Well, that was like a hard thing for a lot of people to wrap their mind around. I was like, well, it's a graphic novel you listen to. People are like, well, what? I'm like, yeah, it's be a book, have all this art from different monsters' points of view, classic monster archetypes, but done in kind of subversive ways. And then the idea would have a different style of art and a different style of music for each monster.
Mm-hmm.
To kind of hear from their side. But it was exploring kind of through the lens of this like young man and kind of as he's at the cusp of adolescence, exploring things like that scare me, toxic masculinity or how we other people, you know, those kinds of things, but done in a very fun way too. And so Dave O'Neill originally, and I was like, I loved his art. He was a husband of a friend of mine, Melinda Bass, who's an incredible singer. And I was like, I just was going to hire him for one panel of one song. And he was like, no, let me try another one of these songs. And he was a true chameleon. Everyone, all his art, he's just the sole artist, but it looks like there's like 10 different artists, illustrators. Every song is totally done differently. And it took 5 years of work. There's like 30 different instrumentalists and artists on it. I had to wait to get like the singers I wanted. And I wanted to collaborate with those artists to find ways of things that maybe I knew about them or our friendship to kind of talk about things that we face. So mm-hmm. like I was, you know, Megan Hilty is an old buddy of mine through my wife who understudied her in Wicked, but also through her husband who I used to bartend with. And I wanted her to sing the ghost song, which you're like, why the ghost song with somebody who doesn't feel seen, you know, isn't that interesting that it would be someone who's kind of a celebrity? I'm like, well, people make assumptions about people like, you know, in that are celebrities mm-hmm. all the time. And I wanted to have her sing something that felt a little like rock and roll a bit, you know, which is kind of outside what people expect of her. And it's been fascinating to see that song also done by all kinds of different people out in the world, you know. It takes on a different meaning every time someone else sings it. And that's the joy of, because anybody can play it. So, you know, if a person of color is singing the song, or if a child is singing a song versus, you know, an mm-hmm. elderly person, it's like, if people don't feel seen, they get it. You know what I mean? And so that was the idea, was that each one of these songs would be kind of connected thematically and then have this big ending. And it was a joy to work on over many, many years. And then the idea was, okay, what if we can make it like a stage show? So we started incorporating the art in it with like projections and things. And then a producer in London saw it, who works in, worked at the time at PlayStation, and she does VR stuff. So mm-hmm. she is coding a VR game. So you have a couple of those songs there. I mean, the original impulse was to have different writers write songs with me. And the only one of that actually happened was Joe. I kind of said, I wrote a song about a Yeti and a Sasquatch that are like best friends. So, but all the other ones are kind of me working out kind of how I think about the world. Like the homeless guy down the street from me in near my house in Queens that I've tried to help out many times. I was like, well, how do we, if I try to personify him as like the troll under the bridge that everybody makes assumptions about, what is his story from his mm-hmm. side, and how easily we can dismiss an other someone who maybe just didn't get the help they needed at the right time. So like, those are things that I think is like, they're funny and they're silly, but they're also a little heartbreaking. Like Medusa's song, I wanted to like give Medusa, speaking of Greek myths, you know, she went through a lot. You know?
And she lost her head.
Yeah. You know, but I wanted to like give back the narrative to Medusa. And I was like, okay, what if it was kind of like an Adele darky, spooky piano song. And who can sing? Who could sing that? You know, that kind of spooky thing, but really rock it out. And Katrina Rose Diedrichsen and I collaborated. She's unreal. Like, it's truly when she riffs at the end at that thing. Holy Lord, it's thrilling.
Where can we hear it?
So Broadway Records was nice enough to help me release it, and so it's distributed through them, but you can get it online. It's on Spotify, and they have a full hardcover graphic novel. You can actually read it. It's beautifully printed at Broadway Records.
Can you read it while you're listening to it? Oh, that's amazing.
And hopefully we'll have, we were at NAMPS last year. I've been trying to get into NAMP, the National Alliance for Musical Theater, for 10 years, writing all these highfalutin musicals that I thought were so important. And I submitted Monster Songs. So I was this is the weirdest thing. It's part graphic novel, part virtual reality, video game, part, musical. And that's the one they love the most. And that's what they chose. So we did it at NAMP last year. And it was just a blast, man. It was just a blast.
Well, I know what I'm going to be listening to on the way home tonight.
Please. Yeah. It's fun, man.
Yeah, it sounds really cool. I love how technology now especially can take this traditional medium and really breathe new life into it. It speaks to the younger generation.
Right.
Now
well, again. That's part of, I think, what NAMP was so excited about was wow, how can we push the envelope of what immersive means? Because in a perfect world for me, Monster Songs should be Sleep No More, but a musical, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if it's tricky with sound isolation. Obviously, K-pop was trying to figure out how to do that and things like that. I'm very curious to see how they do it as a proscenium show. But as a musical, as a narrative, it's tricky. But we have it mapped out, so fingers crossed. Maybe we'll have a production one of these days where we get to combine all those things, that kind of full synergistic intake of art and live performance and maybe puppetry or AR and VR and stuff to kind of experience each monster in a different way, so that you're put in their shoes. That's the goal. Again, empathy. It's truly
Are you just keeping an eye out for an abandoned hotel or something that's shutting
You'd be
down?
Surprised. But we have there have been a couple of scopes out to Brooklyn warehouses and things like that. Yeah.
Oh, that'd be so much fun. Yeah. I love you mentioned the Sleep No More. I've been to that. I've been to Then She Fell.
Oh,
which is still.
Oh my God.
And there was something I forget. It was the same company as Then She Fell, but it was Paradise.
I couldn't get to see it, but I saw it.
Yeah.
Well, and what changed everything for me was going to Santa Fe and seeing Meow Wolf.
What was
that? I don't know if you know Meow Wolf. Mm-hmm. It's an artist colony that basically took over this giant warehouse, and they tell this crazy weird stories, but they're all these different artists. George R. R. Martin basically underwrote it for them.
Wow.
And so it's the story that I went to, because they change it up, it's this house that's breaking apart into different dimensions, and these aliens are watching it but feeling the sympathy for this family. The family is the dad's in a cult, and the brother and sister don't know each other anymore, and sister thinks the brother is a homicidal maniac because he murdered this hamster, but the hamster is actually from another planet, and the hamster is evil, and but it's this crazy weird story. But all these different artists design different parts of the house as it's breaking off. So you have this weird black and white section. This weird, this Miro fantasy thing, but the crazy stuff in the house. You'll see everything's tangible, everything you can touch and look and feel. And you read the little kid's journal, and it's got the hamster thing, and you open a portal in it in his bookshelf, and you enter a giant cave, and there's a woolly mammoth, and the giant. That was one of his toys that you can actually make. It's a musical instrument, and it's got lights and things on it. And there's this guy that went into the house, will break apart into different weird sections. So this guy literally opened up a laundry door for the thing that does laundry, the washing machine. He opens a washing machine, and it's a slide, and it takes you all the way down to this giant basement where there's weird monsters and things. It was truly wow, this is narrative. This is immersive. This is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. There was also silks and dancers that were doing and reenacting the story with a rock band. It was just all the things. It was just cool is it when you have art and theater and graphic design and all of these elements come together with kind of escape the room and immersive things and multimedia in every single way. And it was fun. It was so fun. And just being wow, I care about all of these people. And you can stay as long as you wanted, or you could just kind of go through it all and then leave. But you do it all on your own. And it's wow. How cool would theater, if you could create a narrative that you can kind of sit back on your own time. It's kind of a video game can do that
right,
too.
Right.
But in real life.
Yeah. You, well, gosh, I'm trying to understand your psyche right now. And I mean, you mentioned at the beginning of our chat that you know, the time when you got both rejections and you were like trying to figure out what to do with yourself and just the way you've been describing everything, it sounds like you're very cerebral.
Mm.
And like I'm what you really enjoy is where you can be transported.
Yeah. I do.
And the fantasy, like you like aliens, you like other dimensions, you know, you like, I'm sure Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Sure.
And, you know, being John Malkovich, like that whole concept of going into other people's psyches. Do you still struggle with trying to find, like your place in the present, in what we know as reality? I mean, it's kind of a weird question, but like, where you are now, I was originally a few minutes ago was going to say something about imposter syndrome, like when you're coming out at the stage door and people say, "Oh yeah, I want to be a writer because you wrote this great thing," and are you like, you know, but why? I'm just me.
Well, I feel like you know this year, you know, I've like I've gotten a lot of help this year in different ways, like financial help, legal help, and some emotional help, and I think part of that idea of like. Allowing people is coming to terms this year with also allowing people to be moved by something you've written and not dismiss it and say, well, why not? You know, other people, other friends of mine have written things that have deeply, deeply moved me. I mean, you should see me crying during the goodbye song last night, singing with Akanas, you know, and I think it's okay to say, yeah, I did that. But it's not because I'm better than you. It's just I've had more experience at it. And of course you can try that. I mean, I think we all have a little bit of imposter syndrome. I just want it to be good. I try so hard to say, all right, is this in keeping with this character? Is this in keeping with the tone? You know, you work out all these puzzles of how to tell a story, especially in adaptation. Mm-hmm. And you just want to do right by the source material. You want to do right by the author and by the fans and the people who do that. I think it's a little scarier. It's a little more daunting when it's something that's personal, like Monster Songs. You're just like, here's a blank page. Here's this crazy idea I have. And knowing it could totally fail. But it's literally a song I wrote for the Lightning Thief that was cut, the song called Try. It was just like literally this song. It's like, I'm probably going to screw this up. Let's do it anyway. You know? And that's what I think as an artist you have to kind of do. You just have to be brave in ways that are terrifying. Terrifying. Because you know people are going to root for you to fail. But for all of that, there'll be one person it could be an army, but it could be one person that says that changed the game for me. That made me feel seen. That speaks to me in a way that inspires me. And then it really is meaningful. That doesn't go away. And I like to have a dialogue with that, you know, with fans on Twitter and whatever it is, to see where they're at, to gauge their temperature, to say, yeah, I'm with you guys. Let's be part of this. You know, together.
How long did it take to get to this point?
Yeah, oh my God, dude, years. Yeah. I mean, I've been at this since 98. I mean, I'm old. but I think that was the interesting thing to me was like really coming to terms many times with disappointment and how you kind of frame it in your head. I wrote this, I was asked to write an article for Backstage and I was like, oh my God, about advice. And I was like, oh God, what am I going to say? Some platitude or whatever. I'm like such a Debbie Downer half the time. You know, my wife is like, everything's the worst. And I'm like, even when things are going amazing, you know, you're always like, but it's not good enough or it's not whatever. And I keep coming back to this note that I found on a room in Telsey when I was, one of my last auditions as an actor. I haven't acted that much lately, but I saw this note that somebody left there and it was on the floor and I pick it up and it's from some mom to their kid. And it was the most beautiful, heartbreaking, just the advice that I needed at the time. I don't know whose this kid's mom was, but God bless them. but I put the song, I put literally the note to music. And I sing it sometimes for my Cap 21 kids, but, or my PACE students or whoever I teach a lot. But it's like, you know, hi, honey, I just want to tell you that I offer you some advice. Well, you were searching for that special role. You're doing all the right things. And I know it must not be easy. And then this line, keep doing what you can with what you have. You know, it's just like that. All you can do is just keep doing what you can, where you are, with what you have. And I think that advice of is so pertinent to artists and to anyone who just feels like comparing themselves to others, comparing themselves to their past work, all that kind of stuff. It's like you can only do what you can at the time. Mm-hmm. And then the note is like, go to Michael's and make something fun to like spark your creativity. It's like super fun, but like such a mom thing to say that it just makes me laugh. But yeah, that was the advice I used in that backstage article. I was just like, just keep doing what you can, where you're at with what you have, because that's all you can do.
Yeah.
You know,
I really like that quote.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen to the talk sometime. I like it.
Good on you, Mom. Okay, so there are three standard questions that I ask everyone to close out every episode. The first one simply is, what motivates you?
Collaboration. Good stories. Good stories motivate me.
Just telling or reading or hearing what?
All of that. I read a thrilling book the other day called The River. I was like, it inspired me. I was like, that my dad recommended, actually. It's like,
All right. And then the second question is, what advice would you give to your younger self and younger people listening now, starting out down a similar path?
Well, literally what we were just talking about, you know, the idea of trying to make yourself into something that you think somebody wants you to be, there'll be plenty of people that are going to try to put you in a box. You know, it's so hard to say, be your authentic weird self, but like your experiences are so unique that if you put those down and you keep doing what you can with what you have, where you're at, people will respond to them, because our shared humanity is going to be into your specific unique worldview is the thing that we're going to respond to much more than you trying to like, you know, pigeonhole something that you think we want us to see.
All right, so last question. If you could only see one show for the rest of your life, but you could see it as many times as you want, what would you see?
Sweeney Todd.
Another one for Sweeney Todd.
Well, you know what?
Uh-oh.
If you want to change it up, I could say my three favorite shows are Sweeney Todd, Tommy, and Hedwig and the Angry Inch. So I have to say, like, could I say maybe Tommy? I really love Tommy so much, and I'm so excited for the revival. But like, every time I like get something else out of it. I just love it so much. And also the album, the original album. It's just so good.
Yeah. All right. Well, Sweeney Todd is a very popular answer, so don't feel bad about that.
I'm born on Halloween. What do you want?
All right. So everyone, please go down and check out The Lightning Thief, the Percy Jackson musical, which closes on January 5th, 2020. You can get your tickets at lightningthiefmusical.com, and we can visit Rob online at robertrokicki.com. You're on Twitter and Instagram at rrokicks.
Rrokicks.
You can get more of me at thetheaterpodcast.com. Show your support at thetheaterpodcast.com/Patreon. Get me on Instagram and Twitter, theater_podcast. Please leave a rating, leave a review. This is edited by Matthew Hendershot, music by Jukebox the Ghost. And then Rob, thank you for the wonderful chat. This has been incredible.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Make the world a little colorful.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.